Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Sober Indians Saturday Night Live. I'm Karen, your host, and tonight we have Luther coming on to share his stories with us. So sit back and take a good listen. Luther, thank you for coming on and sharing with us this evening.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I'm pretty excited. And again, I appreciate you reaching out. And I appreciate everybody on Sober Indians for tuning in tonight.
Absolutely.
Pardon?
I was just going to ask, do you want to tell everybody a little bit about yourself? And then we'll kind of go into your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll introduce myself. Gagi Gagabo, Indigenous Kaz. Awasisi Ndude, Mississaugai Gunning, Ndu Jaba. My name is Luther Sam. I'm from Mille Lacs Lake Reservation, Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Reservation. I grew up on the south end there on the big lake of Mille Lacs, right on the reservation there. So you just kind of want me to jump right into it there, Karen?
Sure. Let's go ahead and get started. And by all means, the floor is yours.
All right. I appreciate it. So again,
you're
my
welcome.
Name is Luther Sam. I've been in and out of recovery since I was probably about 14 years old. I'm 35 years old today. 35 years old, I think. So I guess my story about recovery, addiction and recovery, is like that of many great stories of recovery. I started drinking at about the age of 14. And right from the start of my drinking, I started experiencing blackouts. And it was like that for quite a long time. I mean, there was nothing really bad, like, with my home life. I grew up with between my parents, my mom and my dad, and they're both really good parents. I got siblings that didn't really experience addiction until later ages, but for some reason I was drawn to alcohol. So from about 14 I started drinking, and like I said, I experienced blackouts, and with that came like assaultive behavior. Like I was combative when I would get drunk and I would like to fight. So right away I started getting in trouble with the justice system, started getting in trouble with the law. And of course I would go to juvenile corrections, detox centers, hospitals. We can almost say I've experienced just about every kind of state bed they made. I think I experienced at a real young age. So getting involved in the criminal system at a young age, I mean, that carries a huge, huge burden throughout your life. And so I would say most of my schooling was criminal justice correction schooling for quite a few years. So then I guess, you know, I turned 18. I think I got my first felony charge. It was an assault charge at about the age 17. And with Minnesota law, you can actually be tried as an adult when you're 17, and so that kind of happened with me. I got a third degree assault, which was a felony, and this was, you know, quite a few years ago. So I guess with that was that on top of being in active addiction, I mean, and then living on the res, and then of course being Anishinaabe, Native American, you know, you really got a big hill to climb when you're going through that kind of stuff. So then at about 18, I started to get involved with, I actually broke my arm and was prescribed Vicodin. And it was great. But I also, around the age of 18, I started using methamphetamines. Back then, on the res, people that use meth, we were kind of really looked at in a really weird, kind of crazy way. It was really frowned upon and shunned. But I was using meth. And then so that was a big crazy experience. My whole meth experience. I was snorting it and smoking it. And that was about the age of 18, and that went on for about 5 years. I was really into meth and the lifestyle that came with that. Of course, funds were a little bit tight back in those days for me, so I had to do what I had to do to get money for meth, which involved robbing and stealing and a lot of that. Was people that was closest to me, of course, my family, my siblings, aunts, uncles, and things like that. So that was a mess from about 18 to 23. Anyways, but I continued drinking. I was still drinking. I was still getting in trouble with the justice system, of course. And then, like I said, I broke my arm around age 20, and they prescribed me Vicodin, and then that was that ended up being a whole nother thing too. The whole start of my opiate journey, Vicodin, and of course the meth, and then drinking, and then opiates, and then I don't even know how to explain all that this day and age. But I mean, a lot of people that can relate to the meth lifestyle and the opiate lifestyle, you know, kind of understand what I'm trying to explain. And so I think at the age of 23, I was sentenced to 36 months in prison for, a few different cases, mostly were felony assault charges that they actually ran concurrent. And it was my first time in prison at the age of 23. And I sat out of that 30 months, I sat 2 years. And of course, I got involved in the gang and the drug politics and the group politics and prison, of course, fighting and things like that. And so I didn't really use the justice, the criminal or the corrections system the way it was intended to help people grow back then. And so when I was released, I wore that on my sleeve. It was kind of a badge of honor. You know, I thought I was cool. I thought I was a tough guy, like that. And I got out, and of course I connected with some people that I was in prison with for different drug connections. And then when I got out, I utilized those connections to contribute to my, cause I started using again right away when I got out. And so that was kind of my way to supply my addiction. And then that was about 25 or 26 years old. And I was worse. I was worse after I got out of prison the first time. It wasn't good by any means. And so I continued the active addiction lifestyle. Only at this point, I started getting involved with heroin. And I started out just snorting the heroin. You know, it was a bigger bang for your buck. I wasn't doing the Vicodins or the Percocets or the Oxycontins anymore. It was heroin lifestyle. And then of course I started to, distribute heroin and to supply my own habit. And if anybody that's been in active addiction, which I'm sure a lot of listeners have been, when you're using and selling, it doesn't turn out very well at the end. Either you end up back in prison or you end up dead. There's no, mm-hmm. or you recover. You know, those are your three options. So I actually ended up back in prison again for I think this time I ended up in prison for like counterfeit and bad checks and credit card fraud and that type of stuff. that place window. And so I went back to prison for a couple of more years. And then this time it was a little bit different. I kind of strayed away from the gangs, although I was still involved with prison politics and fighting and things like that. But I was wanting to change this time around, and I was pretty sincere about wanting to change. And so when I was released, I really try to utilize the Native culture, AA, NA, Wellbriety, through the White Bison and things like that. And it was going pretty good for a while, maybe almost a year. I developed some really good connections with some really good people that knew about Native culture and Native tradition. And so I ended up being in a relationship with this female that was an active user. And you know, she was using and I was in doing the recovery thing. Really hardcore, like AA and NA, and I actually started up my own meeting. It was based around Wellbriety and White Bison. And then of course I was making it to AA and NA meetings, and part of that was stipulations of my parole. And it went good for a little while. I don't know how to explain or how to say, like, when you're with somebody that is unhealthy, it doesn't, and especially like when you're in early recovery yourself, it's not, it might be good for some people. Like some people I'm sure make it, but a lot of people don't. And I was one of those people that didn't. So I went back to the using lifestyle and I hit it for quite a while. You know, I was still going to trying to do ceremony, and make it look like I was doing good, but I wasn't. I was in a full blown relapse with this girl that I was with. I wasn't drinking and I wasn't doing meth. It was just a full blown heroin addiction. I think at this age, I was about 30 years old. I started using IVs. I was an IV user for heroin. And it was by any means, by all means, don't become dope sick. And if anybody's familiar with heroin, you know how nasty the heroin withdrawals could be. And so it was, you know, I was with this girl for maybe almost 2 years, and about 90% of that was just fighting and getting high and being dope sick. And I ended up catching some new charges for financial transaction fraud that I actually went to jail for and bailed out and skipped my bail. So I had a warrant out for my arrest. And then that's not fun either. You know, I'm from the res where everybody knows everybody. So anytime I seen like a vehicle, I would have to hide or hide in the back seat, you know, to not be seen by the tribal cops. And if anybody out there is familiar with having warrants, you know how great of a feeling that is. It's horrible. So I had this warrant out for my arrest, and it was the craziest thing. My girlfriend, she took off, and you know, she was out messing around on me all the time and cheating, and you know, that was that kind of relationship. And of course that sparked a lot of drama within the relationship, and wherever she went, she was gone one time, and I had this bail bondsman kind of hunting me down, and I had this warrant, and I remember it was just, you know, I was desperate. I was dope sick. I was out of money. I was out of any way to get high. And, you know, I fronted from all the dope people around. So I owed everybody money. You know, I lived in this house, with my brother actually. And my brother was actually addiction as well, heroin addiction as well. He was an IV user, and we were both living in this house together, and it was a typical drug addict house. I mean, there wasn't much in that house. I'm sure it probably stunk. You know, we couldn't have people over, things like that. So anyways, I was at the absolute bottom. You know, I remember my mom actually came over to pick me up to help her run some errands. And I think it was kind of part of her plan. So I got in the vehicle with her and we took off down the road. And I shit you not, about 10 minutes into the ride, she just started laying into me about kind of the way I was living my life and her expectations of me and how much she loved me and the possibilities that she's seen within me and things like that. And you know, I mean, there's my mom and I'm stuck in the car with her, and, you know. So yeah, I mean, she would just drilled into me bad. And so for a half hour ride one way, we did what we had to do, and then we drove back. And the whole way back, it was just about how much she cares about me and, you know, all these other possibilities I could be doing with my life. And I'm almost getting choked up thinking about that car ride. it was tough. You know, all the bullshit that I pulled on her and did with her and stole from her, for her to have me in the vehicle that day and tell her how much she loved me, it really meant a lot. It really made me realize that, you know, as active IV heroin users, that I'm still human, you know, that people still care about me, people still love me, even if it's from afar. So anyway, she dropped me off, and I just felt like absolute hell. I still had a warrant for my arrest, and my girlfriend was still gone messing around on me and whatever she was doing. I'm still not sure, but I'm sure it was probably not good. So that next day, I gave the bail bondsman a call. I had his number, so I gave him a call, and I told him, I was like, look, if we can take care of this warrant, would you be able to, if I came up with the money, would you bail me out again? I didn't want to have a warrant. So he agreed to it, yeah. So anyway, so I prepped myself to turn myself in. Got money somewhere, somehow, and got high, high as a kite, I suppose some people would say, and told the bail bondsman where I was at. He came and he picked me up and he transported me to the jail. You know, so I turned myself in on that warrant, but I felt like I was ready to, I felt like that warrant was my golden ticket out of the lifestyle that I was living. So he came and picked me up and brought me to jail and sat in jail for a couple of days and became extremely dope sick. And, they brought me in front of the judge, and of course they gave me another bail. It was like $500 or something like that. And, I got back to, my cell, and I took that bail bondsman's number and I shredded it. I ripped it up. I flushed it down the toilet and said, the only way I'm going to get over the dope sick and the withdrawals was going to be absolute isolation. Nothing available, you know, like that. And so I flushed his number. I shut my, cell door, and it was absolute hell in that jail for the next 3 weeks, I think it was, before I actually started feeling better. I ended up getting a Rule 25, which is consolidated funding, to get into treatment while I was in jail. And so I was able to get furloughed from jail to a treatment center. And so I did that. And whatever happened with the treatment center, I ended up actually getting kicked out. And so I had to go back to jail. But at this point, I was about a month and a half off of dope, cigarettes, meth, whatever. So I had like 6 months or something like that of DOC time hanging over my head. And so I ended up getting a hold of my caseworker, and I didn't want to be in jail. I would rather go back to prison. And so they ended up working that out. I ended up going actually back to prison for about 6 months. But within that 6 months, that last time I was in prison, I really, I don't know how to say, did a lot of reflecting. But I ended up reading like a lot of books, and I was kind of still involved with prison politics. But it was at the point where I was really trying to learn, and really trying not to be involved in the drug lifestyle and things like that. So while in prison, I started actually reading a lot of books and about Native American history and culture and things like that. Of course, doing a lot of exercising and, you know, out on the yard or out on the shoe, out on the flag. You know, I just had some really serious one-on-one conversations with the brothers about wanting to be a good dude. Taking online classes in the prison, and what was some other things that I did while I was in the prison? I can't even think about. I was doing a lot of good things, utilizing different programs in the prisons that was going to help me after I got out. And so I ended up doing that, and I was released. I was released on parole. But I went to a halfway house. up in Mille Lacs around the res. I went to halfway house, and this halfway house, it was culturally centered. The curriculum at the halfway house was based around Anishinaabe, Ojibwe practices, cultures. They really encouraged people to partake in the sweat lodge ceremonies, which are great. I'll talk a little bit about that here in a little bit. I utilized that program the way it was kind of intended, and it really helped build myself up culturally. And of course they required you to do AA, NA a few times a week. And of course I got a job right away after I got out. So that was great. I was in the halfway house for a few months, three, 4 or 5 months. I can't really remember. It really helped. So I'm going to kind of fast forward here. How long have I been talking now?
What,
a half hour?
We've been on for, half hour. I did have a quick question before we fast forward real fast. You said that you started at 14. Did peer pressure have a role in that in any way? Because I know sometimes at that age, when someone at that age starts drinking and into different experimentations with stuff, it's because of peer pressure.
No, absolutely. I grew up on the res. I mean, that at that age, there's not a whole lot to do. Of course, we did have a community center, but I know that there wasn't really a whole lot to do on the res. So there was some guys my age, maybe a few years older, that I used to hang out with, and of course they drank, and that's kind of where all that started. And again, it was nothing like I didn't have like a bad home life or anything like that. My dad, he was a hard worker. My mom was a hard worker. She loved her kids. So it wasn't nothing like that. It was just, you're right. It was just the influence from other kids on the res. Peer pressure, I would say, might be an okay word to use.
Well, we can, if you want, we can fast forward. I also wanted to ask you about Sober Indians group, and what impact has that had on your life, being part of the group as well?
I got involved with Sober Indians quite a few years ago. I think when I was introduced to Sober Indians, I think there may have been, I would say maybe 2,000 active members. I don't know what it's at now. It's quite a few. I know a guy who's really helped me along on my journey. I actually met him the first time I was in treatment, which was about 18 years old. He used to work at a treatment center, the same treatment center my grandma Dorothy Sam actually was working at. And his name is Patrick McCoy. And this is a brother that's really helped me along on my journey. And he's the one that actually introduced me to Sober Indians quite a few years ago. I want to talk a little bit about Sober Indians here, but, first I kind of want to talk about, the impact, the Anishinaabe culture, the Ojibwe culture, traditions and practices has helped me become kind of healthy in where I am today. Of course, I am this time around. I will be coming up on 5 years of sobriety from heroin and meth. I would AA and NA are some really fantastic programs. And the fellowship within them groups are amazing, and I don't want to take anything away from AA and NA. I know it helps a lot of people. But for me, myself personally, I took a different route. And that route was through Anishinaabe Native American culture, the language, the songs, the dance, the ceremony, like that. One of the biggest things that helped me get to where I am today was the Madudu Swan, or Sweat Lodge ceremony. So to develop my personal sobriety, it was built around that, of course. AA and NA, it wasn't for me. I really relied on our ceremony, and just like AA and NA, when you go to ceremony, you develop fellowship with other brothers and sisters that are a part of that. And there's quite a few guys that helped me along on my journey. Patrick McCoy, obviously he's one of them. He's been great. There's another brother, Ogama Ganu, his name is, and I don't know if he's listening, but if he is, I just want to say buju to him. Ogama Ganu, Bob Eagle, he's from the res up there. He's really, helped carry me along on my sobriety. Terry Kemper, I mean, there's just been, some really amazing guys. Another really constructive support in my sobriety has been my significant other. Her name is Hannah Hollenkamp. She's been amazing. Of course, I got a 13-year-old daughter. Her name is Brooklyn, and she resides with her grandpa, Joe Nakunabe Senior, who's been phenomenal. And really inspiration to me in my recovery. And so there are just a few guys that I've helped, and I know there's many others. But so along with the Sober Indians group, and I know that's more of a like an online Facebook group. I've been a part of another group, the Sober Squad, the Natives Against Heroin group, which is some other groups you may be able to find them online, but they're more part of boots on the ground in the recovery community, and they do everything from peer recovery coaches to Natives Against Heroin. They're really phenomenal about confronting dope dealers head on. And that's kind of headed up by James Cross, out of Minneapolis. He's been phenomenal. and then another group that's really helped me along the way is Men's Empowerment Group. And that's headed up by myself and Ogama Ganu, Bob Eagle. That's a group that we started over there in Mille Lacs. And these are just support groups for recovery. The Men's Empowerment Group, they really were really about kind of how do you say, tapinama wa sema. We kind of lead with the tobacco and the medicines, and we're more culture driven, the Men's Empowerment Group. So that's phenomenal. But again, the Sober Squad, they're more based around like peer recovery support and AA and NA meetings and 12-step philosophy. And that's headed up by Colin Cash, who's phenomenal. I mean, he's a great dude. He's actually my cousin. I spent a lot of time with him growing up, first cousin, so he's more like a brother. He's been phenomenal. You guys can look some of these people up. They're amazing. If you really want to get some great support, again, Ogun Maganu, Colin Cash, James Cross, Tom Howard, he's been great too. And then Patrick McCoy and the Sober Indians. So I want to take you back to within the prison system, correctional mm-hmm. system, is kind of a lot like boarding schools. Okay, so they took Shinabe, Anishinaabe people, they took Native people kind of from all over, and they forced them into one place. Okay, so when they did that, they try to correct them, or they try to make them be a certain way, right? Boarding schools, they wanted us to, you know, kill the Indian, save the man. The DLC corrections is you know, is Native people really family orientated? And so when you take us from all over different places and you put us together and you try to break us down, because we come from different places, we bring teachings and understandings with us. So when you take us from different places and put us together, what you're actually doing is you're making us stronger. Boarding schools, they did it. Prison systems, they did it. And so a lot like the sober Indians and the Natives Against Heroin and the Sober Squad and the Men's Empowerment, AA, NA, these groups, you bring us together and we bounce ideas and philosophies and teachings off one another, and we become strong, we become great. It's exactly what Sober Indians is doing. You're bringing people from all over and we bounce ideas and teachings off one another. And we got to understand that what we're taught is the right way, no matter where we're from and what we're taught. And so it's not fair for somebody to come in and say that's not right, or that's not how we do it, or that's wrong, because it's right to you. It's right to you as a person. So it's good to share, and it's good to have that unity and that bond. So Sober Indians, I don't know how many active members it is. I think it's coming up maybe even close to 100,000, if I'm not mistaken. Karen, would you happen to know?
I believe it's at 73,000 members right now.
73,000, which is phenomenal. So you got 73,000 people that are looking for support, and 73,000 people that are bouncing ideas and philosophies and encouraging one another. I mean, that's making a phenomenal group of people, an amazing group of people. And I'm really excited to be a part of that. That's great. And I really encourage people just to keep going. Relapse, you know, a lot of people say it's part of recovery, and that's true. You know, people that relapse, people that got so many years of sobriety and relapse, we never lose those days. So just keep counting them. I know for like AA and NA, they give you 30-day tags, and for some people, you might have 5 30-day tags, but you know what? You never lose the amount of sobriety days you got, regardless of how long your relapse is or how many relapses you have. Just always count those. Always count those days, because they matter. You know, like that. It's been a phenomenal group, and. Karen, do you have any questions, or should I kind of keep going?
Well, referring to the group, explain, because I see a lot of support in the group, but I want to know how that support alone has helped you along. because you're right, the group is phenomenal and there's a lot of great people in that group. But how do they help you day by day?
Well, day by day, you know what I really like to see is people from all over. We share a common bond, regardless of where we're from. We're all striving to become and stay sober and just encouraging one another. That support, it's got this common foundation of spirituality. And so that's kind of what I look for, and that's kind of what I'm attracted to, is the common bond of trying to develop spiritually. And it's really good to see it. It's really good to see, regardless of where people are from, how much the spirituality means to them. Regardless of their religious preference, I believe all spirituality shares a common foundation. So I guess day to day, that's kind of what I look forward to, the really encouraging support. And of course, if anybody's familiar with Patrick McCoy, I mean, how can you not be inspired by what he's driven towards and his goal is to help people, encourage people. And regardless of where you're at in your life, whether you're just starting out in recovery or whether you're in active addiction or relapse, or you got 39 years of sobriety, when you come into the group, I feel like we're all equal. We're all on an equal, I don't want to say playing field, that sounds so cliche, but we're all on an even playing field when we're in sober Indians in the group. Now again, it doesn't matter where you're at in your life, we're all equal when we come to the sober Indians. And so I really appreciate that.
Yeah, it's definitely a great group. I mean, you go onto the page and you see a lot of love and support from everybody, from someone that's one day in sobriety to the many years that you were speaking of. And you're right, you don't see a difference in any of that. And I think that's amazing to see that support in just one group alone. So, and it's a great group. And I like being there. I'll read every day. But I don't know what else to ask, because you have said so much tonight, and I'm thankful for you coming on and talking.
Yeah, well, again, I just want to encourage people. Just don't give up. I know with COVID, I know it's really been hard for the recovery community. The impact that COVID has had on us has been like nothing else. I really believe in healing through groups, group therapy, and with COVID, it's just been hard to do. I've been really weary about not wanting to be in groups and really social distance and things like that. So it's been hard. COVID has impacted, I'm going to go ahead and say everybody, whether it was through losing a loved one or becoming sick themselves. It's just been awful. I mean, there's COVID that's had an impact on the recovery community. And it's a tough virus, and addiction is a tough virus, and so we're battling against these two things. But you know, the divine, the Getchimanu, the great spirit, he's given us a way to live that is 100 times stronger than the coronavirus and the addiction virus. If we could just tune in and ride the frequency of the great spirit and live the way the spirit's intended for us, I think we can make it. And again, I know people got a lot of different religious backgrounds in the Sober Indians. But you know, if we trust without a shred of doubt the divine, the great spirit, I think we'll be okay here. But we also got to put in the footwork of staying safe, and that means reaching out to support people that support you in your addiction, and really utilize the spirituality of what we've been given. Always put out our tobacco, our sacred offerings, and you know, smoke our pipes and go to our ceremonies, because that it helps. There's no doubt about it. From the places that I've been in my own life, I mean, I've been to the absolute bottom that I feel that this life can offer, which is, you know, prison. Again, we got to put in the footwork, right? We got to utilize our ceremony. We got to social distance, right? We got to wash our hands. But we're gonna be okay. You know, this is something that's not gonna last forever. Of course, our Native people, we're kind of used to viruses and outbreaks and things like that. And you know, we're here today, and we're strong as ever. And I believe it's because of the divine, the money do, the spirits, the way they watch over us and protect us as long as we utilize our tools. And I just wanna again let people know that coronavirus and inactive recovery, addiction, we can do it, as long as we have each other, and as long as the recovery community is out there, we can do it, and we're gonna be all right. Trust me, and I feel for everybody that's lost somebody to addiction. As a matter of fact, I just buried one of my first cousins the other day, who leaves behind a beautiful family, beautiful kids. You know, I loved him with my whole heart, and it was really tragic to see. And of course, I've buried loved ones to coronavirus as well. But we understand the process of death, right? We mourn and we grieve, and then we celebrate their life. But it's been tough, I'm not gonna lie. It's been a tough year. But for me and the people I was able to reach out to and the people that I have in my life, and I just want to say the social media, Sober Indians, Men's Empowerment, Natives Against Heroin, the Sober Squad, they utilize the social media as a phenomenal tool that's been really easy to tap into, and it's made it really easy to be able to reach out to people. Even if somebody doesn't answer, I mean, you could just always click on the Facebook pages and then become inspired. I mean, how can you not? And I really encourage people to send Patrick McCoy messages. He always responds, and he's been great at using Sober Indians. And again, his name is Patrick McCoy, and he loves when people bug him. So please bug him.
I did have one more question.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to know if someone came up to you and they were at the bottom and they just had enough, what encouraging words would you give them to help lift them up for them to move forward into a recovery?
So if somebody were to come up to me that was in active addiction looking for help, what would I say to that person?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, first I would tell them that I love you, that there's a way out. I would let them know that you're still human. Regardless of what you're going through, you're still human and you got a beautiful soul. You got a very amazing and powerful spirit that resides within you, and you got spirits that are looking out for you, and you got people that somewhere somebody loves you. Even if it's that person that you're talking to right now. And I would really encourage anybody that's struggling with addiction to reach out to treatment centers. Regardless of how much you might not like it, treatment centers are really amazing places to start your journey to recovery. But yeah, no, again, I love you, even if I don't know you. I know that you're a human being, and I know that you got a spirit that lives within you, as well as I, and so that means that I can love. Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing that can trump love. Ooh, I don't want to say that word, but it did. Love. It's all about love. It's all about love, encouragement. Hey. Right. I love you, regardless of where you're at in your life. Just know that I love you, and I love you because you got a spirit.
I like that, and I hope that's helped somebody tonight by hearing those words, because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that needed to hear that. Is there anything else that you would like to say? We're down to the last of the show. So,
six and a half minutes.
Is there anything else? Yeah,
I would just, you could just send a check. Just send it to my home address. That'd be fine. No, I'm just kidding. So I just want to say, you know, when it comes to your recovery, limitations, there's, understand that there's no top. You can always keep striving forward, and just know that there's never going to be a top. You can never be on top. As long as you want to continue to keep striving, don't set limitations. Trust the Creator. He has absolutely unconditional love for you. Everything we have in life is a gift, and it needs to be appreciated and respected as a gift. You know, our kids, our parents, our home, our job. All of this is a gift. Everything that we have is a gift, and just appreciate it as so. In recovery, as a lot of people know, anything is possible. It doesn't matter how far you've gone into drugs. There's hope. There's hope that you can ever that we can always overcome. I don't like using the word rock bottom, but you know, when we hit our rock bottom, it's So yeah, again, don't set limitations. Trust the Creator. He has absolutely unconditional love. Life is a gift. You know, treat your life as a gift. Oh,
absolutely, yeah. Agree with that.
You know, of course, recovery is not without its struggles. Yeah, that was a kind of a quick hour here. Now I feel like these last couple minutes are going to be. Let me give a shout out to everybody that's that's out there, everybody that's doing peer recovery coaching, everybody that's doing their part with the Sober Squad, the Natives Against Heroin out of Minneapolis, James Cross, he's been great. Everybody that's involved with that, the Men's Empowerment Group up there in Mille Lacs. Want to give a shout out to you guys. I want to tell you guys that I love you, and you guys are really helping me, and I'm really glad to be a part of that. What are the Sober Indians? Everybody in Sober Indians, you guys have been amazing. Keep pumping out those encouraging posts and loving one another. It doesn't hurt, you know, to always start your day with a small prayer. Doesn't matter, regardless of how you pray, just always give thanks. You know, we never know what's going to happen one day to the next. Always start your day with a good thank you. Thank you for life. Amigwich, we call Amigwich. Thank you. Yeah, Anishinaabe people, just keep doing your thing. Everybody across Turtle Island, just keep striving. Do your part to, if you can, make it the ceremony. You know, there's a lot of really good books out there. If people look into the Red Road to Wellbriety books, the White Bison trainings. Wellbriety has been great for natives in recovery. The White Bison movement and phenomenal. I really appreciate everybody that's doing that. And I know there's so many other groups out there that are helping people. And thank you. Thank you for putting in the work to help others and help yourself. I know there's just going to be a lot of stuff that I forget to mention, and I'm probably going to think about it later on. But again, Karen, man, I really appreciate you for reaching out to me and everybody in Sober Indians. Just keep doing your thing. Definitely keep doing your thing, Patrick McCoy, man. Keep doing your thing, brother. Ogama Ganu, keep doing your thing. Tom, keep doing your thing. Get your money, dude. Old Meekwitch, get your money, dude. Keep doing your thing. Colin Cash, keep doing your thing. And the list is just absolutely endless. So, yeah.
I want to thank you for coming on, Scott, and sharing your story with everybody. And I thank everybody that's joined us to listen to your story tonight. Thank you for being here as well. And I wanted to say good night. And we will see you all Wednesday night again with another show. And thank you, Luther, for sharing with us. Absolutely appreciate you coming on and speaking.
All right. Thanks, Karen.
You're
all
welcome.
Right. We'll talk
good
to
night.
You guys soon. Huh?
Nope. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Migrit, Gigawabu Min Minawa. I hope.